This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. This hour, we'll focus on two Iowa cities and a musical organization in Marion, Iowa, is extending its reach across the state and the world. Last week, Iowa City, which along with Edinburgh, Scotland, and Melbourne, Australia, has been designated a City of Literature, named its first executive director of Iowa City UNESCO City of Literature. We'll hear from Jeanette Pilak, who starts her new job this spring. Earlier this month, Cedar Falls was recognized as one of a dozen places nationwide as a distinctive destination for 2010. It's now in third place nationally in voting to name the most distinctive city. We'll find out more about the competition. And round out the hour, we'll get an update on upcoming events from Red Cedar Chamber Music, an active group of musicians based in Marion. But first, news from Iowa Public Radio and NPR. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Late last week, Iowa City, first city of literature in the United States, named its first executive director of the new organization, Iowa City UNESCO City of Literature. Jeanette Pilak will start in her new job April 1st. She's now director of the University of California, Santa Cruz Arts and Lecture Series. In Iowa City, she'll oversee operations of the nonprofit organization with an office at the Iowa City Public Library. Iowa City joined the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organizations Creative Cities Network in November 2008, only the third city of literature in the world, joining Edinburgh, Scotland, and Melbourne, Australia. Now, 17 other cities worldwide have formed the Creative Cities Network, which honors and connects cultural centers for cinema, music, crafts and folk arts, design, media, arts, and gastronomy. Cities in the network are known for activities based on the notion of creative tourism. Pilak grew up in Milwaukee and was previously executive director of the Oregon Creative Sciences Alliance and festivals manager of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. First of all, Jeanette, congratulations on this announcement.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled.
When were you offered the position?
Just last weekend.
Mm-hmm. And did you have to think about it very, very long?
Not at all, no. I was hoping that that offer would come through since I interviewed there in January.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about yourself, where you grew up.
Well, I'm a native of Wisconsin. My family is still all there in the just outside of Milwaukee. And since leaving Milwaukee in about 1982, after attending University of Wisconsin-Madison, I spent 11 years in Washington, D.C., and then I moved to Eugene, Oregon, and then Portland, Oregon, and now the last 2 years in Santa Cruz, California.
And in Santa Cruz, you have been the director of the University of California Santa Cruz Arts and Lecture Series. So what was this job about?
That's correct. Arts and Lectures was a 40-year-old program that brought national and international artists, both performing artists and lecturers, book writers, et cetera, to the Santa Cruz community. And it was the premier outreach vehicle for the University of Santa Cruz. So there was many tie-ins to the community, whether it be through education in our artists and education in the high schools and middle schools, or working with the university students and the artists to take other community activities out into the whole Santa Cruz County area.
So it sounds like you've been working with communities, not so much institutions, not universities, but working with actual communities to bring arts and culture and into the communities and get people involved. And you'll be doing much of the same thing, I assume, in Iowa City with this new position as executive director of Iowa City UNESCO City of Literature.
Exactly. The majority of my 20-year career has been in grassroots organizing, be that at a performing arts center or working with municipalities or creative communities and economic development. So it's a marriage of all those entities about why are places vital living communities. What enriches them for the citizens, what attracts others to come and visit those communities, and what best practices can we export out into the world that other communities can use to sustain, you know, that very creative culture and creative economy.
What have you known about Iowa City? Just you're from Milwaukee and you've lived in Oregon, California. You've been following events here. And
well, as a child growing up, it was always my dream to be a writer and attend the Iowa Writers' Workshop. We never know how our paths are going to lead us there, but I'm thrilled to be coming to a university town, a Big Ten university town, which I miss very dramatically. And, you know, I worked in politics for a while I was in Washington, D.C., and so I know intimately the caucus system of Iowa. And I must say that being a Midwesterner and going to D.C. and working in national politics, I was at first very disillusioned by what politics was until I started working with Iowa and seeing every citizen in action and knowing that our great democracy really works. So that's my two reference points for knowing Iowa and Iowa City is the Writers' Workshop and watching those caucuses every year.
Well, those are two major attributes of the state, certainly. Now, you will be the very first person to hold this position, and so that has to be difficult to start in a brand new position. There's no history, there's no former directors. It's a new organization, at least for Iowa City. So, what are your thoughts about this particular challenge?
Well, you know, despite that, there's not a lot of history. There is incredible energy that has been brought to the table from very diverse interests, be they the municipalities, Coralville, North Liberty, and Iowa City, the cultural quarter, up to Cedar Rapids and the university, the publishing industry, the independent bookstores. You know, you've got people who really care and are passionate not only about the community, but about literacy and literature. And a historic institution of the Writing University, but the opportunity to have this vision to look at what impact literature can have on the vibrancy of a community going into the future. So those are some really potent aspects of any startup, that you have people who care, that are passionate about what they're doing, and that they have a vision of where they want to go. For Iowa City, the size of this city to be recognized as the third UNESCO City of Literature, the first being Edinburgh, Scotland, and the second being Melbourne, two cities that are enormous in size and scope of activities and resources, it just shows that the passion and the care of the folks who've come around the table, the current board members and the founding board members, that this makes for a really exciting opportunity. Now, that said, what lays ahead of us is to get very strategic about what resources we have, what resources we're going to need, and what that mission is so that we can make sure absolutely every activity we do is driving the mission forward so that we're using our resources effectively.
Is this position more about promoting Iowa City to the rest of the world, to let the rest of the world know about Iowa City and what the city has to offer as far as literature, publishing, authors, books? Or is it more about bringing more activities to the residents of Iowa City and other Iowans who would want to attend activities in Iowa City?
You know, Dennis, it is some of both. Certainly, in my time looking at this position and talking to folks outside of Iowa, I would say 80% of the folks are very familiar with the Writing University, the Iowa Writers Workshop, and the Prairie Lights bookstore. That's 20% of the folks who aren't, you know, need to know about it. And that's an important thing to do, to use that historic presence of literature and writing in Iowa to let folks outside of Iowa know about it. But there certainly is, and that's part of what the UNESCO designation will help us do, but there certainly is an awful lot that can be done for the local community as well as the entire state of Iowa. There are some incredible best practices already happening, and there's a way to look at literature and the writing programs and the other activities associated to say, what do we want our communities to look like in the future, and how can these activities we're already doing help us get there? And that are, you know, through literature, we find out about the human condition, we find out about social interaction, we find out about ourselves, we find out about people who are very different from us. So what does that mean to make our communities healthy, our citizens of the future, our children, our K through 12 education process? So there's an awful lot that we have to do locally, as well as external to the state of Iowa. You know, that said, there's also the very economic focus of any activity, and that is, how can we bring more people to Iowa City to enjoy what's already there, and how can we take the folks who are already passionate about writing literature in Iowa City, and how can we help them explore, you know, our sister cities in the UNESCO Creative Cities Networks, such as Edinburgh and Melbourne, or maybe the Design City of Montreal, or the Music City of Santa Fe.
So there's 16 cities in the Creative Cities Network. Is that right?
Actually, they just added three more
last
fall, so we're up to 19 now.
And will more be added as we go along?
It appears that they are going to be adding them slowly, a couple at a time, year by year.
Jeanette, thank you for taking the time to talk to Iowa Public Radio, and congratulations on your new job. It's very exciting, and I'm sure you're excited to be moving to Iowa, and you'll be accomplishing a lot of great things. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Dennis. I really appreciated the opportunity, and I look forward to meeting you in person and talking to the public again.
Jeanette Pilak will be the first director of Iowa City UNESCO City of Literature. Iowa City is one of three cities of literature in the world, along with Edinburgh, Scotland, and Melbourne, Australia. And now one of 17 other cities who are part of the Creative Cities Network. Pilak is a native of Milwaukee and will begin her new job in Iowa City on April 1st. Coming up after the break, we'll hear about the voting for the top distinctive destination cities in America for 2010. Cedar Falls now in third place. Talk of Iowa continues in a minute. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese. Earlier this month, the National Trust for Historic Preservation recognized Cedar Falls for its historic charm and character. The National Trust named Cedar Falls as one of a dozen places nationwide as the distinctive destination for 2010. For 10 years, the National Trust has selected communities that offer cultural and recreational experiences different from those found at typical vacation destinations. National Trust President Richard Moe says Cedar Falls downtown is a national model for economic revitalization. The city's cultural and recreational opportunities offer something for travelers of any age. Kim Berger is with the City of Cedar Falls Tourism and Visitors Bureau. Kim, the National Trust for Historic Preservation recently recognized Cedar Falls for its historic charm and character. First of all, congratulations for this. Were you expecting this honor?
Thank you. Well, actually, to be very honest, we all felt like it was a bit of a long shot.
Yeah.
But, gosh, you know, we've got to stop thinking that way.
Mm-hmm.
We were very pleasantly surprised, but yet we all kind of feel like it's a special place.
National Trust President Richard Moe said Cedar Falls downtown is a national model for economic revitalization. Well, the city's cultural and recreational opportunities offer something for travelers of any age. Is this was this award based, do you think, mostly on the downtown restoration?
I think it's a mixture of things. Restoration definitely is a big part of it, coming from the National Trust, but also the vibrancy of the area. The trail system was a component of the application. That's something that kind of makes us stand apart and be a bit unique. So I think it's a number of things that played into it.
Now, the downtown area in Cedar Falls almost got flooded in 2008. And that was a close call, wasn't it?
It was. It was a matter of inches. We had several layers of sandbags up on top of the levee and thousands of volunteers working long, long hours.
When you travel to Cedar Falls, you, beside the downtown, there's lovely old homes in the old part of town, Tremont Street, Washington Street. So there's historic charm and character in other parts of town, right?
That's true. Yes, the neighborhoods are very tree-lined, and there's several painted ladies in the neighborhood with the keeping the historical feel of the area. And also the trail system is integral in the whole Cedar Valley area as well.
The trail system is one thing that both Cedar Falls and Waterloo have worked on for a long time, I know, and it's gotten bigger and better over the last, 10, 20, 30 years or so?
Right, right. We're at 106 miles of hard surface trail, and then we also recently added some water trails, so we've got some paddle sporting going on as well.
Cedar Falls also known for its wonderful trees, although a number of them blew down, last year in a really bad windstorm. But there's a lot left.
That's right. We took a hit in July, but we're getting back. Doing a lot more planting, and, of course, there's still plenty to go around.
Part of this award was given to communities that offer cultural and recreational experiences different from those found at typical vacation destinations, quoting the National Trust. So you don't really, you're probably not viewing Cedar Falls as a vacation destination necessarily, are you?
Well, it's a great place to visit. I would not compare us to Disney World, but heritage and cultural tourism is a very, very large component of the travel industry, and there's a lot of folks that are interested in getting back to their roots, exploring Americana at its best, and Cedar Falls is very indicative of that.
Was part of the award due to the UNI campus, the University of Northern Iowa, which has been, pretty careful about preserving as many of their older buildings as they can and restoring buildings? Was that part of the award, you suppose?
Absolutely. The university is an integral part of the community, and because we're home to the University of Northern Iowa, we've got great cultural and entertainment options that that kind of set us apart. And because of the size of the community, it's easily accessible, and we're able to get up on campus and enjoy the experiences that are offered. It's also very economical.
Okay, could you explain how this process worked, the National Trust naming Cedar Falls as a distinctive destination? Did you apply for this award? Was there national voting, or how was this determined?
Well, it was actually Maribeth Sonneson. She's the director of the Community Main Street organization. She put an application in last September. A number of local organizations, including the Cedar Falls Historical Society and the Tourism Bureau, provided support material for the application. And it was a juried process that took place at the National Trust level.
The other winners: St. Louis, Fort Collins, Colorado, Rockland, Maine, and Huntsville, Alabama. I don't know if you often listen to Michael Feldman and What Do You Know on Saturday mornings on public radio, but on the Town of the Week, Michael often asks the random person selected from the phone book and the random from a random town what good things they would recommend about the town for people who are not familiar with it. I mean, if you had 30 seconds to describe what's great about Cedar Falls, I'm just picking 30 seconds, you can go 40 seconds if you want to. What would, Kim, what would you select?
Well, of course, I would start out with a stroll down Main Street. That's the mecca for this award. And the restaurants and the nightlife and the galleries that are offered in the downtown area can entertain pretty much anybody of any age. And then, of course, the Cedar River is located right downtown, as is the trail system. So it's kind of a hub of activity where you can enjoy a lot of different things.
Now, some voting is going on right now, Kim, I understand, to narrow this this list, the 12 distinctive destinations, National Trust selections, down to, what, one grand prize winner. Is that what's happening?
That's right. We're having some fun with that, too. It's an online voting contest, and you can vote as often as you like to. So we've been contacting all of our friends and neighbors and encouraging them to, you know, show the rest of the country what Iowa is made of. We're a relatively small community in relationship to the others that have been selected. So we're kind of taking this as a challenge.
Cedar Falls is the smallest community, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe so. And actually, we're kind of floating back and forth between third and fourth place in the voting. So we've been keeping an eye on that, and we're encouraging people to visit the CedarFallsDowntown.com website and then just follow the links, and you can vote multiple times.
How long will this voting continue then?
Through the end of February.
And so right now you're in third place, so that's not bad, but have to get up to first place, right?
Well, it's kind of in our blood. That's what we like to do.
So the website, again, to vote is CedarFallsDowntown.com.
That's correct.
And you can vote more than once?
Absolutely. We are encouraging people to vote early and vote often.
That sounds like something you could only do in Chicago, maybe.
It does kind of sound Chicago-like, doesn't it?
What is the current population of Cedar Falls, Kim?
We're just over 34,000. The metropolitan area is closer to 160,000.
Yeah, so Cedar Falls has been growing for decades, right?
Yes, we have, and it's really, we like to tell folks that we're just the right size because things are close enough to get to very comfortably, yet there's a lot of great offerings for a community our size.
And for people who love snow, it's a great place.
Yeah, right now there's a lot of sledding, and there's an awful lot of cross-country skiing going on those trails.
Well, Kim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Kim Berger is with the Cedar Falls Tourism and Visitors Bureau. The voting continues until the end of February for the top distinctive destination cities in the United States. Easiest way to vote, website CedarFallsDowntown.com. Talk of Iowa continues in 5 minutes here on Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese. Red Cedar Chamber Music was founded in 1997 and named after the river in Iowa that was known by that name in the 19th century because of the abundant red cedar trees in eastern Iowa at the time. Their very first program, a collaboration with the National Czech and Slovak Museum, resulted in a CD that received a Critics' Choice Award. Red Cedar is an active group of musicians presenting nearly 100 educational events during the current season. Holly Hart of Iowa Public Radio Classical talked to Jan Boland and John Dowdle, the two Marion, Iowa-based musicians now known as Red Cedar. They were known as the Boland-Dowdle Flute Guitar Trio in the late 70s when they received an award for their first effort for Titanic Records.
Yes, our very first CD was on Titanic with Ralph Dottmeyer, was the guy who ran Titanic. And it was on Period Instruments. It was called Mozart. No, this was
Giuliani Humo
et al. And that got over and was picked up by an organization in Regensburg, Germany, Tage Alte Musik, Days of Old Music, literally. And they gave it a Disc of the Month award. And then ultimately we went over there in 89, was it? I think. And did a concert for that. They have a festival every summer.
Now, you had started as a flute and guitar duo with Authentic Period Instruments. And I wanted both of you to talk a little bit about your own backgrounds in music. Obviously, you didn't start playing 17th, 18th century instruments, which are floating around Iowa. But I know Jan is a flute professor at Coe College, or has been at Coe, on the Coe faculty. And John, you have been, I know, at the University of Iowa.
Actually, when we started performing together, we actually started on modern instruments. Mm-hmm. And it was about 1983 that, as a duo, we picked up the early 19th century instruments. So these are instruments from
about...
And how
did that happen? Why did you decide to do that?
We decided to do that because when we met in 78, we both started... Jan started a doctoral program at the University of Iowa, and I started my master's program. And she was studying modern flute, but also studied with Betty Bang Mather, who was very much into Baroque flute. So she was very involved in Baroque flute playing. As part of my master's degree in musicology, I was playing in the Collegium Musicum, so I was playing lute. Mm-hmm. And for my master's thesis, Jan and I, we went out to the Library of Congress and looked through everything that they had under flute and guitar. And we went back, they led us back into the stacks at that time, and there were just like six boxes. The one was marked A through D, and the next one was, you know, E through G, and so on. And we found a lot of music from the early 19th century, and that got us looking into the history of that period. So our very first formal concert together on tour was in the fall of 79, and in 83 then was when we really started playing the 19th century period instruments.
Where did you get a hold of these? I know that in keyboard there are people who actually build replicas, and I know, Jan, you've mentioned being at the Smithsonian and using a glass flute or being able to rent these instruments.
Yes, not for rent, but actually when we learned that the instruments were from that period, I knew then that it was a wooden flute with multi-keys, maybe 6, 8, 10, 12. And so I thought, okay, now what? Where do I find one of these? I remembered that my sister had said she picked up something at a flea market in Phoenix, Arizona. So I called her on the phone and said, count the number of keys on this flute. And she said, there are 8. I said, would you send it to me? She paid $35 for it. So she sent it to me, and I took it to a repairman who got it playing. And it was not a good instrument, but that's what I learned on. And from then I found very fine instruments from London dealers and so on. The instruments from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, that was a very exciting project, started because both John and I received one of, I think, 10 nationally, they were called individual recitalist fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts in about 1992. And that we could define a project, so we said we'd like to go to the Met and study those instruments. We did that. They, again, allowed us down into the room and just locked us in and said, have fun. And so we were able to go through everything there. Not many of those flutes work, but several of them were played well enough in tune and so on that we chose several to then launch a terrific project that ended up in a recording. And two of those were crystal flutes that you referred to.
And we've got one of those here. It's called Crystal to Gold. Thank you.
And so the instrument that, when we started looking into this, I'd actually studied in Vienna for 2 years prior to coming to Iowa. So I was in the Navy as a Navy guitarist. And then when I got out, I went over and studied in Vienna for 2 years at the Hochschule für Musik. And I picked up a guitar there. They had a large auction house called the Dorotheum, and they auctioned off anything you can imagine, from Oriental rugs to fine jewelry to housewares to musical instruments. And once a month, we would go check things out, and I got this beautiful little instrument. And it had been made in Innsbruck. And so I'd had that instrument when I came back here, and when we started reading about the 19th century instruments, I called Jen and said, I think I have one on my wall. So
I might ask just why you think it was that these instruments evolved. I assume a desire to have a louder or more ability to project sound, but especially with the flute where you ended up with a metal instrument.
Mm. That's always the question, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Did the music drive the change in the instruments, or was it the other way around? I don't pretend to know the answer to that, but certainly the instruments got louder. One of the primary differences is that the homogeneity of the sound is very marked in the modern instrument. Mm-hmm. And from note to note, we practice perfect transitions and color and pitch and so on, which was not the case in the 18th century. And it was not a negative in the 18th century, but that's just the way it was.
When you go back and forth then from instrument to instrument, does it take you a while to adapt, or are you used enough now to all of these permutations that you can just pick up the wooden flute?
Oh, I don't know. It all depends. I'm still known to write fingerings on the music. And for many, many years, I made a determination never to play the same piece of music on the different instruments. Just keep that. When I looked at that piece of music, it was for one part of my brain to go to, and that's worked pretty well for me.
She does make transitions sometimes and plays one piece on both instruments.
Yeah, the easier music I can do that with.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the range of recordings that you've done, because I have a list here. You've done a lot of older Czech chamber music, music around 17th, 18th century Vienna, Bohemian composers and early American tunes. And then you've also branched out into things that were written just a few years ago, and you commissioned composers to write for you. There's a Red Cedar Collection, American Music for Flute and Guitar. You've got Fireflies, music by Andrew Earl Simpson. So I was curious about how you came to decide you wanted to do that as well as the older music. Was just something that you had always planned to do, or was it something that you finally decided you had to express yourselves in a little more contemporary mode?
Mm. For me, I've always enjoyed playing those things that others are not playing. And so I've stayed away from the Poulenc Sonata for flute and piano and things that you study, of course, and are wonderful, wonderful music. But I've always enjoyed finding things that others have not identified as being really worthwhile. So that takes you to older music that that's been ignored.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously takes you then to commissioning new work. Mm-hmm. And that's been a real natural for me.
So you're mentioning now all the different programs that you've been doing and connections you have. And you have a number of programs. You've got your regular season, you've got rural outreach, and a few other things. You mentioned connections with the Museum of Art and school systems. So I'd like to hear a little bit about what you're doing right now and what programs you do have.
We have two that we're working on now. One will be programmed, it's being programmed now, but it culminates in April. And this one we're calling a Dvorak sighting. It is music of Anton Dvorak, whom we Iowans claim as an Iowa composer, even though, of course, he's Czech. But he lived in Iowa for 3 months in 1893.
That's what counts.
That's what counts. That counts. His music, his quartet, American Quartet, was written while he was here. And an amazing Iowa composer, Harvey Sulberger, mm-hmm. born and raised in Marion, where we're from, and went on to make an international career living in New York and in California, has now retired back to Iowa. He's our composer in residence, and he's writing for us.
How convenient.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, it's amazing. He wrote a work. He very much connected to the fact that Dvorak was in Iowa at about the time that his own grandfather was here and living in roughly the same area. And he's imagining that maybe their paths crossed. Who knows? But he took Dvorak's American Quartet, and with each movement, would you call it a companion piece? He was influenced by the music of Dvorak and wrote us a 26-minute work that's inspired by the quartet.
And this is going to be performed when and where?
The culminating concert is going to be performed in Cedar Rapids at the First Presbyterian Church downtown on Saturday, April 10th at 8 o'clock. And that concert is preceded by a series of rural outreach concerts, first on Wednesday, the 7th of April in Monticello, the Thursday, the 8th. Of April in Ainsworth at that little opera house, Friday the 9th in Fairfield at the Sondheim Center, a series of events for senior citizens and kids in Marion and Cedar Rapids, also actually in Marion City Hall at 12 noon on Thursday the 8th, and that's going to be fun. For this main event, these events that I've just described, we're bringing in the Avalon Quartet, which is based at Northern Illinois University. Mm-hmm. Fabulous young quartet who will play the Dvorak American Quartet. We'll have an intermission, and then we'll play the Solberger work, which is for flute, viola, and guitar. And the violist with that group, Tony Dvorak, will play with us.
Well, I wanted to talk a little about your compact disc. You've got a number, as I mentioned earlier, Czech chamber music. There's a Vintage Viennese, Johann Nepomuk Homel, Fireflies, Czech-inspired 21st century chamber music. Some of the covers are really humorous. There's one where you have your instruments hanging over a wall and just the tops of your heads peeking over, and there's another one where you just see the lower halves of your legs walking around with your instruments. And I wonder who is responsible for that. And some of the cute names you have, three guys named Mo.
Well, I think that happens maybe when you're most tired.
Well, you have the reputation of having always these kind of humorous little, you know, it's kind of an attractive element to the programs.
Good. It happens on car trips. It happens when we're walking to the post office. When one sits down to try to be clever, it never happens. So, yeah, it's fun to try to find something that seems appealing on the surface and yet has some sort of relevance to what's inside.
But I want to mention our upcoming CD, because that's also in relationship to a program that we didn't talk about, and that is in June we're doing a concert called Caspar the Friendly, which features the music of Caspar Kummer, a very little-known 19th century German composer, but it's wonderful music, and that will feature the two of us with something we haven't had before, and that's another flutist, Doug Worthen. He'll be playing one of Jan's 19th century instruments. And Mr. Kummer wrote a quintet for two flutes, viola, cello, guitar, and then several trios for guitar and viola and violin and flute. And so we're going to play that concert in June, and that one again will be at the First Presbyterian Church on June 5th, Saturday, June 5th. Period instruments. It's going to be a great concert. Then we're going to record it, and that will come out very soon, because we're trying to get it ready to take with us to Manchester, England, because we've been invited to play this music of Kummer at the British Flute Society's biennial convention.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I wanted to ask a little bit about this. You mentioned Solberger piece. You have a selection from that. Is that correct?
Right. The piece that Harvey wrote, as Jan already explained, was each of the four movements of Harvey's work are inspired by each of the corresponding movements of Dvorak's American String Quartet. So they're kind of like a reworking using the same ideas but putting it in a modern context. But to connect those four movements, he arranged three beautiful little Czech folk songs. So after the first movement, you get a little Czech folk song, second movement, and then you get another little Czech folk song, third movement, then another little Czech folk
song. So this is what we're going to hear a piece of
right
now.
And okay, each of these folk songs is arranged for a different combination of two instruments. So one's for flute and viola, one's for guitar and viola, and the one that you'll hear is called Teche Voda Teche, which means flow waters flow, and it's for flute and guitar.
John, you've talked about your early interest in guitar and flute and having Betty Bang Mather as a mentor. And I was just curious what your original interests were in music. How did you become attracted to the instruments you play and the music you like?
Well, I was in the third or fourth grade in a little town in southeast Iowa, and it was time for me to choose an instrument for the local band, by the way, which was so small that when as a beginner at that age, you played with the high school kids.
Wow.
Yeah, a little bitty school. And
where was this?
In Danville, Iowa.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, has a strong music program now. And if I were to tell the truth, I have to tell you that I wanted to play the snare drum. And my mother said, well, try this, the flute. I'm so glad she did. So I grew up in the Iowa band system, and that's how I got my start.
So, John, how about you? You mentioned your background.
Yeah, my background basically, my mother was a musician, so when I was a little teeny kid, she tried me to get to play piano, and that didn't stick too well. But when I was going to church camp, there was a guy around the fire at night strumming a guitar and singing Charlie of the MTA, which was a big tune that I guess it was the Chad Mitchell Trio did that one. And it was the time of Hootenanny, and I kind of missed the whole Elvis, Beatles kind of thing, but I really tuned into the folk mm-hmm. element, and I really liked that delicate interaction of the guitar and the voice. Two or three people like Peter, Paul, and Mary or the Kingston Trio and the harmonies and just that communication that takes place in folk music. And that's what really got me started playing. So I asked if I could get a guitar, and I had a really bad one for about a year. And then finally my parents thought I was serious and I got a nicer one. But that, I think, really prepared me for the whole chamber music mm-hmm. experience. It may seem that it's not on the same path, but they're really very closely related. You can have chamber music jazz. In fact, the chamber music jazz is very important for Chamber Music America. They have a whole jazz program.
Hmm.
So any kind of intimate communication musically is really a chamber music setting as far as we're concerned.
Do you ever play electric guitar at all?
When I was in the military, I was the lead guitarist in a rock band for the 8th Naval District Band. I used to dance across the stage and then play Johnny Be Good. So, yeah, I did that. But I really didn't like the separation of the sound I was making and having it come out somewhere else. Mm-hmm. There's something about the immediacy of the acoustic guitar and the lack of needing to carry around large amplifiers.
That makes a lot of sense.
After you carry around a Marshall stack for a few years, it's really nice to just show up. It's amazing when we go to a concert, just the two of us, all the stuff we bring, because we usually each bring multiple instruments, and then we've got music stands, and we've got publicity materials, and we have to have a pretty good-sized trunk to fit it all in, and that's without any recording or amplification at all. And if you had that, then we'd have to, it'd be a whole nother level of enterprise. So we're very happy playing acoustic instruments.
So I know you started out Marion-based and performing mostly in eastern Iowa, but you go throughout, I mean, you're talking about going to England, you know, but you also perform throughout the state of Iowa and nearby now, is that correct?
Yes, well, our rural outreach program takes us to eastern Iowa. We had a concert in Des Moines a couple of weeks ago, and we do tour nationally and a little bit internationally. We don't necessarily seek it out as a primary venue for our music, but it's wonderful to travel. We were in the Czech Republic about 5 years ago and did a series of concerts there. And
maybe this isn't a fair question, but I'm always curious if you have a favorite CD that you've done.
Well, it's interesting. Once I put down a CD, I don't listen to it because I've studied it and studied it, and we've edited and we've mm-hmm. taken it apart, and it feels like it's in little chunks by the time you're finished with it. Mm-hmm. But if you let it sit for a year or two and go back to it, then you start to see what everyone else is hearing. And so my favorites often have been the more recent ones, but for some reason we had occasion to go back and listen to the very first one we ever put down, and that's when we'd only been playing these 19th century instruments for 2 or 3 years when we put that down. We were very brave. Mm-hmm. And I said to John, that's pretty good.
Well, that's the one that won the award, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So you never quite know what you're going to hear when you hear it back.
Really. Well, thank you. So Jan Boland and John Dowdle from Red Cedar Chamber Music, and you can find out about their programs, their rural outreach concerts and their schedules, where to get tickets, their upcoming events, and their CDs and other information about them on their website. That's at redcedar.org. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Great. Holly. Thanks for having us, Holly.
John Donnell and Jan Boland from Red Cedar Chamber Music talking to Holly Hart of Iowa Public Radio Classical. Learn more about the group and its spring events at redcedar.org. That's Iowa Public Radio's Talk of Iowa for today. I'm Dennis Reese.